There we go. Welcome, everyone. I will call the Senate Rules Committee to order today. We have several items on our agenda, and the first three are courtesy of Senator, maybe the first three. Anyway, we will open a public hearing on SJR 38.
Madam Chair and members, Senate Joint Resolution 38 proposes a constitutional amendment requiring a two-thirds majority vote of each chamber of the legislature for passage of legislative members declaring an emergency. There are no amendments, and we have not received fiscal or revenue paperwork at this time.
Okay, welcome. Are you here for this, Senator Cruz? Welcome.
We haven't coordinated. What do you want to go first?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Jeff Cruz, Senate District 1, and I've noticed that both Kim and I are limping for different reasons. She's had surgery. I'm old. So that's kind of the way it goes. Madam Chair, the use of emergency clauses has been something that's been under controversy here for a long time, and I think you will have some testimony submitted through all this kind of graphing what has happened with that over time. And having said that, there are some very good reasons for emergency clauses on some bills, and it's totally appropriate. However, it could also be maintained that there have been emergency clauses on bills that aren't necessarily for the proper reason. And so what we are proposing, quite simply, is an attempt to try to prevent emergency clauses from being used in a random way, the way they are now, by requiring a two-thirds majority vote on any bill with an emergency clause. And quite honestly, as you know, Madam Chair, most of the legislation we do here, it's very seldom that simple majority vote that passes it. And this is just a way, from our perspective, to make sure that the use of emergency clauses is for the appropriate reasons. And quite honestly, there are other ways to make bills active before January of the next year, because you can put a date certain into different things. So there are other ways that it can be done. But quite honestly, at town halls, people have asked me about why we do emergency clauses, and of course, from the perspective of the public, it's could be an attempt to avoid the people from having the ability to opine on an issue before it takes effect. And so I would suggest that if we think it's a good idea, and I do, that we ask the people their opinion on it, and we make this change and make it a permanent change, so that we only use emergency clauses when necessary and in situations where the majority of both chambers feel that it is an actual emergency and needs that clause on it. And I think this, we have had members from both parties opine on the floor about emergency clauses all session long. This would take care of that problem, and I think in an appropriate way.
Thank you. Senator Thatcher.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. Oh my gosh, I'm so used to saying Mr. Chair in my Judiciary Committee because I'm the Vice Chair. Anyway, I apologize.
I know, my hair's short.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I am Kim Thatcher, the Senator from District 13. I'll say lucky District 13. Thanks for giving this bill a hearing. This is a bill that proposes an amendment to the Oregon Constitution, as you know, simply because requiring a different threshold on a vote of a bill requires a change to the Constitution. If we would just made it a legislative statute, it can be undone during the next legislative session. So that was the whole point of putting it into the Constitution. As we have all probably noticed, in recent years, lawmakers have routinely saddled many proposed laws with an emergency clause. good senator to my left here mentioned how that makes it more difficult for a referendum challenge, and so basically nullifies that right of referendum. Now, in my speech here that my staff prepared for me, they said, I have pulled every member of committee bill. Well, no, my staff. My staff pulled every committee bill. They do a great job. And there's a little graphic in your OLIS. It looks something like this. And graphs the increase in use in the emergency clause over the years, from 2003 up to 2015. It trends upwards. So the addition of emergency clauses to bills and the frequency at which it has increased has become a normalized part of the legislative process, it seems, in drafting. And I don't think it is necessarily a nefarious procedure put in place and purposely used by legislators to shut out citizens of the referendum process, but the perception, like was mentioned previously, is there. And there's a potential use for abuse for it, and it needs to be addressed. You may remember during the leading up to the last election, there was an initiative petition 49 circulating during that time that would rein in emergency clauses. And it would require, very similar to this bill, require two-thirds vote of each chamber of the legislature. So here's what happened. The Secretary of State's office said that supporters of the initiative turned in over 158,000 signatures in support. However, almost half of the signatures were thrown out. Only 89,000 of them were considered valid, but they needed 117,578 signatures. Emergency clauses aren't defined. This does not change the legislature's ability to enact an emergency clause. Sometimes there are just very good reasons. It just needs to happen before the 90th day or 91st day after a law is passed. But one of the reasons for these waiting periods, the 90 days after legislative session ends, is that it would allow for citizens who wish to refer a new law to collect signatures and be able to refer a bill. It also allows legislators and the governor's office to have some time to consider potential issues. So it's good to keep that in place as often as we can. The Constitution, Oregon's Constitution, that is, guarantees its right, the right to referendum for all its citizens. And I just think it's a good idea to put a check and balance on the laws that we pass. And the people out there certainly like to exercise their ability to refer a bill. The word emergency is used at least 26 times in the Oregon Constitution. And it doesn't, like I said, doesn't define it. But I think we all agree that there are times where we need to be able to use it, and I think we could likely muster up two-thirds of a majority in each chamber in order to deal with emergency. Thanks.
Thank you. As I recall, we recently used it in the city of Newburg.
Yes, we did.
Questions from the committee. Senator Farrell.
I do, and what I'd like to do is demythologize, maybe demystify a couple of aspects on emergency clauses. They are a dandy device to prevent the referral by citizens to voters. And that, I think, has become their principal purpose in most cases now. They're also, if the bill that you add an emergency clause gets signed before the signee die or within a few days of its passage, it becomes dandy fodder for the next election cycle. You know, we close out the long session, hopefully July 10th by law this year. The emergency clause allows a bill to go into effect immediately on passage or upon signature by the governor, as opposed to January the following year. So it becomes campaign fodder. So both of those reasons have nothing to do with whether there's an emergency, other than in the minds of the people that are trying to pass the bill or prevent it from being referred to citizens for their input. So for those reasons, I think this is a great idea. I'll support the bill, and I can't wait, Madam Chair, for the work session that I know will be scheduled soon, as if there were an emergency.
Other questions from the committee or comments? I must say that I have a little bit different view of the. I happen to be in the crowd that agrees that the emergency clause has been overused. And I look at bills sometimes and I see an emergency clause. It just seems to kind of appear there without people even asking for it.
Yes,
so we
agreed.
I don't know where this stands right now, but I have been participating in a little work group to really get legislative counsel to make it so you actually have to request it. And I know in our committee that three of us are on here, we don't send anything out without emergency clause, without bipartisan agreement, consciously raising the issue, do we need this or do we not? And I think that there may be a variety of ways to handle it, but I think the issue that was raised is correct. I think it's been overused.
Well, and Madam Chair, if I may, I would add that this legislature is mindful of the emergency clause and its overuse. Future legislatures may not be, and so that's why this proposal to enshrine it in our state's constitution.
And if I could, Madam Chair, I would suggest the Senate is mindful. I'm not sure the other side of the building is. But having said that, it's also a matter of the optics from the public as to the way we operate in the legislative assembly. And that has taken on a tone in the public that I don't think is in our best interest. And so I'm, you know, there was an attempt to put it on the ballot. How signatures get approved or disapproved is a whole different subject that we won't go into now. But I would suggest that allowing the people to vote on this, which is what this bill proposes, would do nothing but improve our standing as far as the public is concerned, with full understanding that the legislature tends to be in the same class as used car salesmen, and I'd like to see us raised a little bit above that.
They're not as bad as we are. Are they?
Well, no. Okay. My apology to used car salesmen.
All right. And I might also note that it's already not allowed to use an emergency clause for a tax measure. So we're part of the way there already. Other questions, comments?
Yeah, Madam Chair, we...
Senator Boquist?
But we've changed what we call tax measures. That's how we...
Yes, we have.
Well, that's for the 3/5 vote. I don't believe it's been changed in terms of the emergency.
Madam Chair, what the good senator was referring to is the fact that there are things that many of us consider to be taxes that have been defined otherwise.
That's a good question. I still think there, I think anything to do with tax administration does not allow an emergency clause. But I could be wrong.
Madam Chair.
Senator Perry.
Just because we're delving, and we shouldn't probably, we should focus. I think the thing that Senator Boquist and the other senators may be referring to is once a tax measure is enacted, we have legislative counsel's opinion that says that we can raise the tax, lower the tax, eliminate exemptions and deductions without a constitutional majority. So the strict interpretation that we have from legislative counsel is that a measure for raising revenue is the creation of the tax. The modification of the tax, which is actually mentioned in the Constitution, which should be require a constitutional majority, according to our legislative council, does not.
A three-fifths,
yes.
Yeah. Well, you go see, you can eliminate a tax deduction, you can change a rate, you can modify the base, you know, you can do a lot of stuff that people would normally define as a revenue-raising measure without having a 3/5 majority. So the problem that we run into is once a tax is created, it's like allowing it to run, it's a free range tax. It can do many things.
It still has to get the vote, Senator Perry, at least some votes.
Right. Madam Chair, but as Senator Farrelly was saying, at that point it only takes a simple majority vote.
Correct. Yeah. Okay. Senator Roblin.
I actually believe we've overused. I try not to use emergency clauses. I agree with that. I do have a problem at times, though, when 10 people out of the group could decide to kill a bill as opposed to 15, because most of what we do in government, it was designed that a majority of the people who represent in the legislature represent a majority of the Oregonians should have the right to do things. And the more we put into it saying that they can't do that, the less likely it is that the majority of Oregonians actually get the will that they would like, as opposed to the will that a minority has decided they don't want them to get. So it is a constant deal in my head trying to figure out how do we balance that with regard to at the end of the day. And I've had lots of town halls and talked to lots of people about that. So I think the indiscriminate use of it is really bad. We need to get that under control. I'm not sure that constitutionally making it impossible, because if you have something that people believe, what everybody would agree from the standpoint of it needs to be implemented now, but it can't get to the 3/4, therefore it can't pass, may not be the best answer to this problem. So we just have to work on that.
I have a question.
Senator
Sure. I don't think it means, Madam Chair, and to the good senator, that it doesn't pass.
Right.
It just means it can't go into effect immediately.
Right.
So it would still pass.
Okay.
It would just
thank
go
you for
into
that
effect
for
later.
Thank you for that clarification.
Yeah, take the clause off and you got it. So.
No, but I'm saying, he's saying if it doesn't get the 2/3, but it gets the majority, the bill would pass, but the deal would go away. And is that how the bill's written?
That is the intention.
Okay.
So if it needs to be clarified further,
okay. that's
that.
Important from my perspective.
Yeah.
Because I thank you for that clarification. That would be the truth.
Yeah. Thank you. Other questions? All right, thank you very much. We will close the public hearing on SJR 38 and open a public hearing on SJR 42. Sheree.
Madam Chair and members, Senate Joint Resolution 42 proposes a constitutional amendment requiring that each legislative measure be introduced at the request of a member of the legislature and prohibits the introduction of measures by legislative committees. There are no amendments, and we do not have fiscal or revenue paperwork at this time.
Okay. Welcome back.
Thank you. I guess I get to go first this time, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Kim Thatcher from Senate District 13 still. Okay, so the lucky District 13, as staff just said, it does just that we would have legislative sponsors on every bill. I pulled bills going back to staff, I should say, pulled bills going back to 2003 to see how many were introduced without a legislator's name. And there's a chart similar to this in your meeting material, looks like that. And you'll see that probably an average of over half are introduced with a legislator's name on it. And I guess just under 50% go the other way. Sometimes they're at the request of an agency. Sometimes they're at the request of the committee, what have you. It's another difficult way to find out who's responsible for proposed legislation is when bills are designated as a committee bill, like orphan amendments, I'll call them. These committee and agency bills are anonymous. And this form of introducing bills allows legislators to, in essence, duck and hide potentially from bills that they've introduced. Some of the most controversial legislation has been introduced as committee bills. For example, during 2016, the minimum wage bill, SB 1532, was introduced as a committee bill. During this session, HB 2875, the coffee tax, and HB 2006, that reduces citizens' mortgage interest deductions, were introduced as committee bills. Nobody wanted to put their name on those. But the issue of these bills being controversial is not the point. It's perfectly fine to have and introduce controversial legislation. I think all of us have done it at one point or another. What this bill wants to do is have a legislator put their name on the bill so people know who to talk to and hold accountable. Questions, know where to direct those questions. Another kind of bill that is usually absent a legislator's name are those requested by state agencies. Before each legislative session, agencies pay legislative counsel, right here, our legislative counsel, to draft statutes for consideration. It's fine, but I would like to see agencies find legislators to put their names on these drafted proposals as well. When legislators won't admit what legislation they are creating, Oregonians are left a little bit more in the dark This would add more transparency. A legislator could introduce a bill anonymously on a group's behalf and get a big campaign contribution from the group, but Oregonians would have a hard time connecting the dots. In my opinion, I think this bill will help cultivate a better respect for the separation of powers between the different branches and encourage more communication between them, between agencies and legislators, for instance. And I also think that having legislators put their names on these bills will give the public a better direction of who they should be talking to when they're looking things up on OLIS and have a complaint.
Madam Chair, Senator Jeff Cruz, Senate District 1. It's quite simple. We hear a lot of rhetoric about openness and transparency. And this is what that's all about. I have never proposed a piece of legislation I wasn't willing to put my name on it. And for any legislator to want to propose legislation that they need to hide from, they shouldn't be doing it. You know, I mean, that's reality. Now, having said that, there have been some pieces of legislation over 20 years that I proposed that I didn't really like, but that's called, you know, doing things for constituents and things like that. But that's all explainable. But I do think that it is appropriate, you know, once again, for shining a better light on the Legislative Assembly if people aren't hiding behind the closed cover of committee bills, for example. And I would also agree that, you know, the executive branch can propose whatever they want. And they propose some things strictly for political purposes. And I think if the governor wants a bill that she can't get one legislator to like the concept, she shouldn't be submitting it. So quite simply, the legislative process is ours. And we are the ones that make the decisions. And I think that it's time that we pulled the veil over some of the secrecy that goes on in this building and have people sign on to the bills they're sponsoring. It's really no more complicated than that.
Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, you know, I've thought about this a lot of times. We've all done work groups in the session or committees and then come back and introduce the bill. So I guess under your idea then, the entire work group would introduce it, list their names on behalf of the committee on interim committee on X. Is that the way it'd work?
I would suggest that, and let's say, for example, you and I were on the Public Records Task Force, okay? And we had a bill that came out of that. It came out at the request of, which is absolutely fine, but I would also suggest, Senator, that if you and I had wanted to sign on as chief sponsors, we would have had no problem doing that, okay? You know, it's like the foster care work group that...
Huh? So I think we might have.
Yeah, it wasn't a bad bill. You know, I mean, it's like the foster care work group that the governor created. The main bill that came out of that was one that was a member-sponsored bill. We did that on purpose. Just to show that there was bipartisan, bicameral support for the concept. I think it can work to our advantage. You know, if we sign on to the work we're trying to create, and it's really no more complicated than that.
So I suspect, with respect to the executive department, what you would probably see would be either the speaker or the president introducing the bill at the request of the governor.
Yeah.
Just as a courtesy, regardless of which party was in control.
Madam Chair, Senator Beyer, that's true. But by the same token, you know, the work we were doing in the foster care system, if the Attorney General had a separate piece that fit in with what we were doing and had come to me and said, this is another piece we need to look at, and it fit, I would have been happy to be the sponsor of it. So it's not necessarily leadership. I mean, there are other people that could be sponsors of it as well.
Yeah, I guess there's a lot. I mean, I have a general policy that I've observed all the while that says anybody who comes to me and wants to have a piece of legislation introduced, I'll introduce it
yes.
at their request.
Yes.
And I just do that.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of times, not very often, but occasionally it's something there's no way in heck I'm going to support it.
Right.
And I tell them that. And since it's your right as a citizen to have a piece of legislation considered.
And Madam Chair, Senator Beyer, I've done that as well. And you know, I will, that's why I said, you know, my name's on it. But, you know, what I will tell the constituent is, you know, you need to plow your own way through the committee structure because I don't support what you're doing. But I'm more than happy to get your idea into the process. And my name's on it. But at the end of the day, that's part of our job.
So, Madam Chair.
Yeah, please.
I didn't mean to interrupt you. Go ahead. I'll follow.
You go first.
Well, I was just thinking that there has been legislation that I've declined to sign because I can pretty much kill a bill in this process as the minority Republican by just putting my name as a sponsor. That bill's dead. They'll find a siding to put that bill on, and it'll just sit there and rot. But I was thinking about, I really love the idea of constituent bills at the request of. We have no obligation to do that. And it would be interesting to see bills on energy, for instance, at the request of Tom Steyer. You know, that certainly would be revelatory to some people. Or to have bills on taxes at the request of the Koch brothers. You know, and you'd put that on the bill, and that certainly would give that bill a certain cachet that it might not otherwise have. So, you know, honestly, it would liven up politics. It'd be a step toward full disclosure. I could go back to putting my name on pieces of legislation that I actually wanted to see passed instead of ones that I wanted to see killed. Madam Chair, I think this has got some, I think there's some intriguing ideas here. Thank you.
Senator Bokowitz.
Okay. I might want to stop typing. These guys are going to get embarrassed, Eric. We have an existing, here's my question. Okay? We have an existing Oregon Revised Statute law, an existing law, right, that says that if a individual comes to your office and asks you to introduce a law, and you as the senator introduce it, that you're required to put their name on the bill at the request of. That's an existing
yes,
law
that is
already
yeah,
today.
Right. Yes.
So it's already the law.
Right.
It's
mm-hmm,
not something, no good idea. But having said that, there is, I would say, the vast majority of the bills and the vast majority of the members do not do that. They don't follow that law, which is why you don't see the Koch brothers or my good friend Michael Bloomberg now. My good friend Michael Bloomberg, you know, we're like this. I mean, I'm in his lap, right? I know his cat well. We just don't see it. So the question I have down here is that, you know, and of course, I get asked about, you know, let's see, I had the dueling bill, right? Right, right.
Yeah.
I had the dueling bill, so that one's out there. I had the Sharia law bill for a constituent, okay? We just had a bill on the floor, right? You know, and I'm certainly going to use those characters from the Firearms Policy Coalition in my next newsletter so that everybody can see just what sort of graphics these people are. But having said that, if I don't do it, under existing law, there's no penalty. Nothing whatsoever that I'm aware of. So taking this idea right here that you need to not do this or you need to put it at the name of a senator or something like that, or the senator needs to represent it. What teeth, what are we going to use? And we're on the honor system now, and it ain't working. So do we have any mechanism, or what's your thought process on the mechanism of how we make it work?
Well, quite simply, if we make this change to where it has to have the name of a legislator on a bill to be drafted, then if it doesn't have the name of a legislator, it can't be drafted as a bill. It's no more complicated than that.
Follow-up?
Follow-up, please.
Okay. And if it's the legislator, and just follow this through,
you're right,
just
right,
more confident than that, and the governor comes to you and says, right, I want you to draft this bill. If
right,
we just pass this as is, then the existing law, in theory, would mandate that you have to put down the Governor Brown. This is on behalf of the request of Governor Brown. But there's no enforcement for that now.
Well, I would suggest that would be something we could task legislative counsel with as making sure. Have you ever gone down there to draft legislation and they ask you if it's at the request of? Because I never remember them ever asking that question. And that would just be a simple protocol.
Actually, it's on the top of the form.
Yes, it is.
It is. It is. It's on the top of the form. But when they're drafting, if they actually ask it, it would theoretically clear that up.
Senator Roblin.
So currently when the governor or agencies ask for a draft, do we charge them?
I believe that they do pay, the agencies pay money to our legislative council.
And so if we switch this, they will no longer have to pay. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, just checking.
I don't think that's going to break the budget. So.
They put in a lot of bills. I saw other names.
Well, they put in about a third of the bills.
Yeah.
Madam Chair, I just want to point out a little wrinkle in the law. It's the legislators that are required by law to put the sponsorship and the request of, not the drafter.
That's true.
So I thank the Lord we're on the honor system here.
Senator Farioli, you're right, but I would suggest that if that was part of a standard protocol, because I would suggest also that a whole lot of legislators don't know that's how it's supposed to work.
Most of them have never seen the form.
Yeah.
So if this were to go through, you could have, because there are a lot of bills that you introduce kind of for the good of the order. We've got a big one coming up this week in the marijuana committee. And so in that scenario, you'd have an individual.
Yeah, there's two.
This week, I said.
One at a time.
1 week at a time, please. So in a case like that, then you would envision having the bill introduced by Senator Burdick at the request of the Committee on Marijuana.
You could say at the request of Senator Farioli.
Yeah.
Well, then it really would
be. Madam Chair, some of those I said you didn't like anyway.
Okay. Yeah.
Plus, there's no approval for that, so he'd never know if he put it on the bill.
I really struggle with this because I am so comfortable with the notion of, you know, putting our names on amendments, you know, when you're actually working on a bill. But sometimes, you know, if you've got a bill out there that you want people to look at on its merits, and you know that you have really, really made some people mad in various different quarters. Mm-hmm. That, you know, it's really a balancing. The transparency is so important, but sometimes it gets you in trouble.
Well, Madam Chair, I would point out two things. Number one, there have been times when I have done things that have not pleased all of my constituents. I know it's hard to believe, but it's true. You know, but that's just part of the job that we have. And it's easy to explain to somebody who may be upset at something I introduced.
No, I actually am talking about our colleagues,
right,
not our constituents.
Oh, our colleagues. Okay.
The people whose votes we're trying to get.
Okay. And I would also suggest, Madam Chair, we can't talk about marijuana in this committee because you have a quorum of the Senate side of that committee on this committee. So
we're doing it in open session.
But
this is a public session.
In fact, we get Floyd here, we're all here. So
that's correct. All right. Senator Roblin.
I remember hearing, it was before I got here, that there was a Republican speaker or whatever who decided that there should be no names on any bill so that they would all get equal treatment. I don't know if that ever happened, but I know that was a conversation at one time, just because they felt that you wanted to talk about the substance of the bill, not the people who did it. This is kind of the opposite side of that kind of conversation.
Okay. Yeah, but Madam Chair, Senator Oberland, you know, to a large degree, both of these measures, we're looking at the optics and how it appears from the outside as to how we do our business and the transparency, and us not trying to hide from things. And so it's easy for people to know who is responsible for the various things that we do. And I think at the end of the day, that's good for the legislature and our process.
All right. Thank you. Other questions?
Well, Madam Chair, yes. The answer to the question of being blamed for a bill that you
put in for as a committee bill for somebody else. You simply need to put in a member of the opposite party that I don't like who serves in the swing district.
That guy did it.
Right. Always creative, Senator Farrelly. All right. Thank you so much.
You bet.
Thank you. The next one is
okay. All right. We will close the public hearing on SGR 42 and open a public hearing on SB 665.
Madam Chair and members, Senate Bill 665 requires that the name of the member or committee requesting a set of proposed amendments be disclosed on the amendments and allows additional sponsors to be listed by request. There are no amendments, and we do not have fiscal or revenue paperwork at this time.
Welcome, Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Vice Chair Farrelly and members of the committee, my name is Alan Olson. I am a senator representing Senate District 20, which is the heart of Clackamas County. Back in 2012, I introduced a bill on transparency. And that bill has moved along every year, and I keep bringing it back. And this year, I sponsored Senate Bill 665 that we would require all legislators to put their names on amendments they have drafted. This is important for accountability and transparency in the legislative process. Before the 2016 session, there was not an option for legislators to put their names on amendments. Before 2016, there is not a single amendment in the legislative record on OLS that has a name responsible for an amendment. For the first time during the 2016 session, legislators were given the choice of putting their names on amendments. And here are some of the statistics. In 2016, there were 206 people, or 70% of the House amendments had a name attached, which left that 30% did not have a name attached. And then the Senate side, we were a little better. We did 73% as compared to 27% that did not attach their name to an amendment. And I'm sorry about this, Senator Beyer, but it came up in my reporting here that in 2016, Senate Bill 1547, which was my bill, was a very simple bill, had 30 words in it. And the Dash 18 had 19 pages. And that became the Clean to Coal bill. And that bill, that amendment, did not have an author on it. And which is fine. As I heard the good chair mention the fact that sometimes you don't want to put your names on things because, you know, you don't want you want them to pass, and the good vice chair says the same thing. If your name's on there, it could be the death wish. But the fact is that if you're proud enough to write an amendment, you should be proud enough to put your name on it. And our colleagues and our constituents should and deserve to know who writes the legislation. I mean, when a bill has gotten stuffed, everyone should know what the repercussions are of that action, and we do it all the time. And it's fine that it's done. It's a good process to do, but everyone should know through transparency who did it so that they can see and say, well, this person is doing a good effort to take either a bad bill and make it better or take a great bill like mine and make it worse and clean to coal. So I just ask that in 2013, I will say that we had I had the same bill. We had 65 members out of 90 that agreed with it, and we couldn't get a hearing on it. So I would just ask that this is an opportunity for us to take advantage of that. Now, if you look at the hierarchy of the situation and the way we do business here, what takes precedence? Constitutional provisions, adopted rules, custom usage and precedence, and statutory provisions. It's way down the list. We can change them anytime we want to change them. But the fact is our constituents deserve to know who writes the legislation, including you write the bill, you write an amendment. I would request that this bill pass because that way you would put your name on there so that the people understand where the legislation comes from. Thank you very much, and I'll take any questions.
Thank you, Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Manager. You pointed out a good reason why sometimes you don't want your name on a bill when it finally is enacted. It doesn't look anything like what you introduced. But your name, if we had passed that other bill, would still be on the bill because you couldn't take it off if the Constitution put your name on the bill.
Right, but this is not constitutional. This is statutory.
Well, you're talking about rules And are you talking about statute? And the one comment I would make about that is the Constitution is clear that only the legislature can establish the rules
right.
by which it runs. The courts have been fairly clear that we can pass, and I could give you a lot of examples,
right, I know.
All the statutes we can do that the next legislative or subsequent ones totally ignore.
And we do it all the time, man. Yeah. You discussed in this in your last discussion, and there was quite a bit of joviality in that last discussion as to.
Yes, my point is to play. I understand your point, but I think the place to do it is in the Senate rules.
Well, we do have it in the Senate rules, but it's pretty apparent that a lot of people don't want to put their name on there, and I think it's rather incumbent upon us is if you're proud enough to write that amendment, you should be proud enough to put your name on it. Stand up and say, I did it. Now, it might not pass. It might be bad. People say, hey, that's not really a good deal. But the fact is that you should stand up and take credit for it.
Aren't they all? I thought all the amendments had names on them.
Yeah, I thought all of them did.
No, they don't. Now, in 2016, I can give you the stats again. On the Senate side, 27% didn't.
I just assumed it was a rule. I know we always. Yeah.
I haven't thought about it. I haven't thought about it. May I?
Yeah.
I haven't thought about this, but I guess I know in my business and transportation committee, a lot of times some people come up and, you know, their bill and they say, but we need this technical fix. And so we just say to the committee administrator, okay, work right. with them, get an amendment. And I guess, I don't know who.
That's when the committee goes on. Is
I guess that becomes a committee amendment then. Are you opposed to that?
Probably not. I mean, because we know who the chair of the committee is. You just blame it on them. as an example, we just passed a bill. It came to Human Services, and I recommended that they put on an emergency clause. And my name's on that amendment. I don't have a problem with that.
Two of them.
Yeah, actually two. Yeah.
Crazy emergency clause. <wasn't>
Yeah, I've been taking them off
twice,
my committee.
In the same meeting.
Okay. Other questions, comments?
Madam Chair.
Senator Farrelly.
Well, I think it's interesting that you mentioned coal to clean. So that's twice that Tom Steyer's name's come up in this committee hearing.
Yes.
Yeah.
Maybe his name should be on there.
Great bill.
On that
that's
happy
a request
note.
Bill.
All right.
He doesn't have a cat, though.
All right. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you very much.
We will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 665 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2298. Cherie.
Madam Chair and members, House Bill 2298 requires that all specified candidates who appear on a primary or general election ballot must file a statement of economic interest with the Oregon Government Ethics Commission. There are no amendments being offered in association with this measure, and fiscal and revenue paperwork both indicate no impact associated with this measure.
Whose name's on this bill?
Yeah, who's behind this?
I do see Mr. Burson in the audience. Maybe you could come up and help us out here a little bit, Ron.
What, do we need him?
It's on.
You want to pass the bill? Do you want to listen to this guy talk?
It's a public hearing.
At the request of Kate Brown for Government Ethics Commission. It's right on here. Where it came from is sitting right on the bill, okay?
You have 30 seconds to save this bill.
Yeah, and I'm sure you left out a comment. You can either talk or you can watch your bill pass. But you can't do both.
Go ahead.
The difference.
He wants it to pass. He's following instructions.
The guy follows instructions. Give me a break.
He's already agreed to carry it.
I appreciate the committee having us. My name is Ron Burson. I'm the executive director for the Ethics Commission, and after 24 years of marriage, I do try to listen to folks. So I'll try to be very brief here. This is a housekeeping bill. This is Marie Sheffers. If you have any questions on the bill, but essentially the language that requires third-party candidates to file SEIs, as you folks do, as sitting senators, and as other candidates do, is very confusing with the kind of a they mix up the words statewide general election and general election. This is our attempt to clarify the language to make sure that third-party candidates after the primary also file a statement of economic interest. It was the legislative intent at the time for all candidates to file, and this is our way of clarifying that.
Okay. Senator Byer.
Thank you, Manager. So just to be real clear, so this doesn't require an additional filing by someone that has just filed one the previous April.
Senator, Chair, verdict, Senator Beyer, no, it does not. This is no additional filings whatsoever by anybody. If you are a candidate for a statewide office, as listed in the statutes, then you will file a statement of economic interest, whether you are one of the major parties that are in the primary, or you are a third party candidate that does not have a primary.
Okay, so just to clarify, the rest of us who have gotten here by major party nominations, this would have no impact on us. It's just that one category that was left out.
Chair Burdick, they were not left out. They are currently filing. However, the language is very confusing to them on the due dates and when they file, either confusing the two terms, general election and statewide general election, and what that means. And so we're trying to clarify that statewide general election is the November election. And instead of saying that it's 70 days before the general election and you have 30 days to file, we're saying that you will file within 40 days of the statewide general election, trying to take all the math out of it so there would be no math, and just trying to clarify for folks so they know exactly, once they agree to become a candidate for these statewide offices, that they will have this requirement to file an SEI.
Billy is a housekeeping bill. Senator Roblin.
So if the person who gets this nomination was a filer before in a different category, so they've already filed for that year, would that count for them, or would they need to file again as they get ready for the election? They were a mayor.
Chair Burdick, Senator Roblin, if you're only required to file one statement of economic interest, the current filing system will recognize all the positions that you're in that require those filings.
Let's be real clear on that.
Senator Byron.
So if Senator Roblin decides to run for governor next time, having just filed his legislative filing, will he have to file again?
Chair Burdick,
as a gubernatorial candidate?
No.
Okay.
So, right. Senator Roblin's filing for running for governor against.
You heard it here first.
Kevin said that you heard it first.
Right, of course, this is how rumors start.
List.
Okay. Other questions?
Yeah, I saw Mr. Burson listening intently based on his 23 years of experience. And I think he still heard wah, 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 wah.
Okay, thank you very much.
Fine.
Thank you.
All right, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2298 and open a work session on House Bill 2298. Sheree, do we have all our paperwork in order, et cetera?
Yes, we do. There are no amendments, Madam Chair, and fiscal and revenue paperwork both indicate no impact associated with this measure.
Okay. Senator Farioli, do you have a motion?
Madam Chair, I do. Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2298 to the floor with a due pass recommendation as recommended by the entire committee. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Farioli has moved House Bill 2298 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Womp, 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 womp. No.
Is there any objection? So ordered. Senator Boquist, you will carry this bill. All right. Committee, that completes our work. We are adjourned.